At the end of 1940, CBS News correspondent Robert Trout hosted a review of the year's events by the network's top correspondents. It was the first such program in broadcast history, and it began a custom that continues to this day in one format or another. Well, today our commentator, Robert Trout, remembers many of those broadcasts, especially the one in 1950, when Edward R. Murrow and his colleagues made some predictions on the half-century yet to come.
In a young man's game, old reporters suddenly seem to be in demand again. Just one more strange phenomenon, I suppose, that comes at the end of a century. Not only was I recently welcomed back to CBS, I found myself encountering former colleagues with refreshing regularity lately. As the end of the century looms, the hunt for witnesses has found us. I hope you won't feel slighted if none of us nominated John Lennon or Princess Diana as Person of the Century.
And now you will hear from Bob Trout, whose voice often has been the first to bring you the vital news that during the next hour passes in review. Bob Trout.
Yes, this is the story of 1940, a date, perhaps, to be fixed in history with such years as 1914 and 1861. We cannot yet, of course, pass final judgment upon the year that ends at midnight Tuesday. Only the future can give us the ultimate meaning
of these 12 crowded months. That future, which was perilously uncertain in this week 60 years ago, is all history now. We're on the other side. It all came out well. And tonight, final judgments can be safely called in. As a prophet, I must say I wasn't all bad. Today, 1940 does stand along 1914 and 1861, but so would many other years that lay just ahead. A reporter often lives by luck, and for the luckiest of us, the best reward in the end may well be sheer survival. Enough time on the planet to watch the stories we covered develop into the defining themes of our age. And then, if we're really lucky, enough time to see how they all turned out in the end. In my recent encounters with former colleagues, the focus of the conversation was on a similar gathering convened on January 1, 1950. That year, Ed Murrow used the CBS tradition of year-end roundtables to convene a mid-century checkpoint. Of the seven reporters who were on that program in 1950, only Larry Lesueur and Howard K. Smith would return to judge their forecasts. For them and the rest of us, we end the century with at least one satisfaction. There are few troublesome loose ends. The great plots of the 20th century seem to have ended on a note of unusual resolution. What we once called the German problem seems settled. The communist experiment was, in the end, maybe less than it seemed during the 45 years of the Cold War. But none of this was certain in 1950. Herewith, a few glimpses of that world and where it seemed headed on New Year's Day 50 years ago. First, a quick review from Eric Severard.
We flirted with imperialism, gave it up because we really didn't care for it. We fought two world wars, took the initiative for world government with the League, gave it up, took the initiative a second time, and now find ourselves rather unwillingly one of only two great powers in a bisected world. And upon our shoulders is the terrible responsibility of preserving the free civilization that Western man has developed through laborious centuries. We may not succeed at that, but no one else can.
No one else could, because World War II had reduced Europe to poverty and made America rich and powerful beyond its dreams. Howard K. Smith on Europe.
After ruling the world with no competition for about 400 years, Europe's situation began to change radically around the year 1900. Once the seat of all the world powers, there is not a single big power left in Western Europe. The explosive problems that started it all are still there. At mid-century, this is Europe's third and probably last chance to solve them.
The third chance would be golden. Today, the developed nations of Europe are so intimately connected that what was called a general war in 1914 and 1939 would more accurately be a civil war in 1999. The rule is ancient ethnic rivalries cannot breathe or survive in an era of economic well-being. But in 1950, economic recovery was only beginning. In a world of two superpowers, the big question was, is war inevitable? But to measure the prospect of war, you had to understand the nature of the Cold War, as Howard K. Smith did.
I can't believe that war is inevitable. The Cold War is a peculiar kind of conflict. Material interests are not directly involved. The Russians haven't got anything we want, and we haven't got anything the Russians can't do without. The conflict seems to me to be psychological, a matter of suspicions and ideologies.
Psychological it was, which is why we use the phrase age of anxiety so often. But we would spend the next decade building for total war, as if Russia were the new Germany and some of the mistakes of the 30s would happen again. So a policy of massive retaliation prepared us for an atomic Armageddon, but left us restless with limited wars, in which containment and credibility were the main military goals. Of all the reporters around that table in 1950, I think the one who saw that most clearly was Larry Lesueur.
If we could cut it down to the foreseeable future, I think that a final conflict between the United States and Russia doesn't have to take place. But limited clashes between small allies are not only inevitable, they've already occurred. I think it's a question of hoping for the best while we keep our powder dry.
The final conflict never happened, but within 6 months, limited war would materialize in Korea. Then Larry made a bold call that spanned the next 50 years.
My chief concern is that the question of war and peace must dominate the rest of our lives, and that there'll be some very dangerous periods ahead, especially after Stalin dies. On the other hand, the whole communist movement may break up within the next 50 years. I think our best hope lies in patience and the cultivation of allies.
Larry's prediction would be off by only a decade. In the meantime, we would find that the cultivation of allies would link us to some appallingly disagreeable bedfellows, a danger pointed out by Winston Burdett.
If that is so, then our task is enormous. We can never accomplish it by a purely negative policy dedicated to the idea that everything anti-Russian is good.
In 1950, nearly a third of the discussion centered on the United Nations. The phrase world government had not yet acquired its suspicious connotations of black helicopters and the Trilateral Commission. It was spoken of with some hope, largely because world government would be shaped by the UN, and the UN was America's child. Larry Lesueur.
And the very physical presence of the United Nations in New York has made a tremendous impact on these representatives from all the corners of the earth. The one time everyone listens is when the delegate of the United States speaks. The United Nations can't accomplish more than the member states put into it. It can't provide military security for the world, but it can and it does provide moral authority. Its great strength lies in its ability to focus world public opinion.
After much idealism and many false hopes, that would probably be the wisest assessment of what the UN would become by 1999. As to what the United States would become, only Bill Downs mentioned civil rights, and no one imagined Cuba or Vietnam throwing such a shadow over the next 50 years. But nobody argued with Howard K. Smith when he said,
"Almost every time I start tracing some individual European problem to the possible source of remedy, the road leads to the USA. It's clear to me that the fate of the world in the next half century will be decided nowhere but here."
But there was this caveat from Ed Morrow at the end.
"Whether we like it or not, the awesome responsibility of the leadership of the free world has been thrust upon us. We didn't seek it. We have come into our full inheritance at an early age."
As Daniel Shore, George Herman, and I listened to that program recently, Morrow's words echoed. Even after half a century, we sometimes seem as uncertain of that inheritance as we were in 1950. Daniel Shore.
"The United States is kind of the one last superpower, but such a reluctant superpower. Is it really possible the United States is going to opt out of the United Nations Assembly over a matter of whether Planned Parenthood people can or cannot talk about the possibility of abortion in India? If you establish a vacuum, somebody else will fill the vacuum. We are very busy at the job today of creating vacuums."
George Herman.
"You know, in 50 years in journalism, I've only come up with two Herman's laws. And one of Herman's laws states, following up on what Dan said, that in the United States of America, thank heavens, no trend ever arrives at its logical conclusion. And sort of as an overcast on that, the American people themselves still haven't decided whether they want to be the world's policeman or not.
If the 20th century is ending on schedule, don't expect the 21st to start right away. By many accounts, Europe did not find its major themes until 1914, and America until 1933. But those themes have great momentum and will not be replaced easily. We should not assume the course will always be forward. 100 years of progress has been too much progress for some, which is why a century defined by objective science is ending in a coda of retreat from reason into energy fields, crystals, aliens, psychic superstitions, and a belief in the higher order of the irrational and invisible. Is there really a person of the century? Each, I suppose, has his own. 100 years from now, historians will know only that those who regarded John Lennon or Princess Diana with such esteem lived in far more tranquil times than those who chose Winston Churchill or Franklin Roosevelt. We are formed by the events that accompany our coming of age. For me, it was the Depression and World War II. For younger reporters, it may have been civil rights, the Middle East, or the Internet. People find their heroes in experience, not history, which is why the early years of this century may seem less important than they were. It may not be fair, but those early generations have taken their traumas and triumphs to the grave. It is the process. This is why life can move on, why tragedy and suffering do not accumulate in the human spirit, and why a next time may be just ahead when the last time has been forgotten.
Commentator Robert Trout lives in New York City.
Blues, 20th century blues, they're getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues? Why, if there's a God in the sky, why shouldn't he grin high above this dreary 20th century din?